It's the Steve Fast Show on WJBC. Naveed Jamali grew up as a typical American kid. When he wasn't helping out with the family business, he was soaking up pop culture adventure on TV, like Magnum PI or the network broadcasts of the James Bond movies. He longed for a life of adventure and had hoped to gain it with dreams of joining the Naval Intelligence Service, just the way Tom Selleck's character had on Magnum PI. One day, he would enter a world of intrigue and espionage, but not in the way he, or probably most people, thought to envision. He writes about his career as a double agent in a memoir, How to Catch a Russian Spy, The True Story of an American Civilian Turned Double Agent. And he joins us now to share his story. And we welcome Naveed Jamali to the show. Naveed, thanks for being with us today.
Hey, Steve. Thrilled to be here.
So for 3 years, you communicated with a Russian military intelligence officer, secretly reeling him in. But your entry into this world of espionage wasn't in an exotic location or some unusual circumstance, really. It began with your parents and working in the family business. What sort of business did your family run?
Yeah, that's right, Steve. They ran a small, of all things, federal contracting firm that supplied books. I know, it sounds very exotic. But that's, yeah, you're absolutely right. That's how I kind of got into this whole shindig.
What they did was just look up files and get things for people. Was that part of your duties as a kid?
They were supplying Naval War College and a lot of these big universities and getting highly technical manuals. But, yeah, I kind of, so I certainly, as a young kid, I remember spending time in the office, and you know, certainly I remember the stories about the Russians.
And it was something that you got pulled into when you were a young adult as well, right?
Yeah, absolutely. If I can take one step back, the whole way that my parents got into this is, or I got into this, is that the Soviets showed up at my parents' office in the late 80s and wanted to buy some books. And shortly after they left, the FBI came knocking and said, hey, we want you to keep, take care of these guys and just let us know what they want to buy. So this went on for almost 20 years. And so as a young kid, I sort of saw this, and it became almost a running joke at the family dinner table that, oh, the Russians came today, and I'll have to call the FBI tomorrow. So I just became somewhat desensitized to the whole thing.
So this was just a regular order of business for them. The Russians would come in, they'd ask for some sort of records that they were trying to completely legally obtain, right? This wasn't as if your parents shouldn't have been giving them.
That's absolutely true. Everything was direct under the auspices and oversight of the FBI. So no questionable moral decisions and certainly no legal decisions or anything that sort of circumvented the law. It's kind of a gray area. This was not secret or top secret material, but there are things that are known as export controlled, as we know with China. So some of these documents, they probably weren't meant to go to the Russians, but the FBI was aware of it and they wanted to kind of keep things going.
And this is all long before the Patriot Act, where there would be NSA provisions to track, say, if somebody checked out 3 or 4 certain documents from a library of some sort. This all started in the 80s. So for your parents, it might have been an unusual occurrence, but it wasn't something that anybody necessarily knew would be watched.
Yeah, I mean, look, people make a lot about this, that they tend to focus on, hey, this was a secret or classified information. And the reality is it was all what is known as open source. Now, that doesn't mean that there's no value in that open source material to the Soviets and then the Russians. I mean, this is all research material from, prestigious universities and DARPA and things like that. So these were very highly technical pieces of information that had some value to the Russians. And for the United States, perhaps the most intriguing and important thing is that there's a line that says, your enemies may know what information you want, but you only tell your friends what information you need. By the Russians coming in and saying, hey, we need information on these subjects. We need information on how aluminum, I'm just making something up, how aluminum is manufactured in this process. It told our side, our intelligence community, that, hey, the Soviets and the Russians have a deficiency and they're interested in getting information on that. And that's what's known as an intelligence gap. So essentially the Russians were admitting that these were things that they didn't know. Those were weaknesses. And that has a huge benefit to our side.
We're talking with Naveed Jamali. He is the author of a new memoir called How to Catch a Russian Spy. It tells the story of his own experience as a double agent. So, Naveed, you had, as a young man, applied to an intelligence program in the Navy, but you weren't accepted to the program, right?
That's correct. you know, after September 11th, prior to that, I sort of worked this traditional technology career, and after September 11th, I just felt that I wanted to do something more with my life. It was a very devastating time. I'm a New Yorker through and through, and I found this great program in the Navy, applied, didn't get in, had a great recruiter, Lino Covarrubias, who told me, hey, Navid, if it's something you really want, apply again. Just make sure that when you do your second application, there's something slightly different, something that shows growth. And that's when I went to the FBI and said, hey, guys, do you think if I help you, you'd write me a letter of recommendation for this program?
And you were taking a larger role in your parents' business at this point.
That's right.
They were getting closer to retirement. And so you thought, well, I'm doing more with this. I know that the Russians have been coming here since the 80s and that we've told the FBI what they've wanted to check out every time since then. So what did you do? Did you just walk into an FBI office one day or when you called them to say, yeah, the Russians wanted to check out this technical manual or this study? I got an idea for you.
Yeah. No, totally, Steve. And that's just an interesting thing. I looked at this whole, the Russians, the FBI, we looked at them, my parents and I, and certainly when I kind of came in, we looked at this as an account. Now, mind you, it was a tiny account. I mean, the company, you know, while it was a small business, it did okay for itself. And it wasn't a profitable thing. I mean, selling a few books, and it was very, you know, time-consuming. So I picked up the phone one day and said, hey, guy, call the FBI, the FBI case agent that was assigned to this, and said, hey, I want to introduce myself, and, you know, I'm going to be taking over. And I thought, perhaps we get to grab a cup of coffee. And that's sort of when I naively made my pitch and said, look, I'm going to be taking this over. I'd like to help you, and perhaps there's something, you know, and this is just to be upfront with you guys, this is something I'm interested in, and if there's anything you guys could do to help. I was looking at this, Steve, honestly, like as an internship. That's how naive I was.
So did you worry, even though you were naive, did you worry when you presented this idea to the FBI that they'd say, no, what are you talking about? We have people that do this.
You know, that's pretty much in a weird way. That's kind of almost how they said it. I mean, what I found going forward with the FBI was a very sort of very intricate relationship I had with them, with case agents and asset. And they, you know, they could be pretty withholding, and they certainly held their cards very close to their vest. So yeah, essentially they said to me, I had this great idea and I was all excited, and they said, it's very interesting, but you know what? We're totally happy with things as they are right now. And but they left a little bit of room and said, you know, just make it natural, and if he's interested, we're interested. But they never, you know, they kind of gave me a little bit of a challenge, but they certainly weren't like, yeah, this sounds a great idea. Go have at it.
So what was the first thing you did to try to escalate this relationship with these Russian people that were coming in to obtain this information from the business?
So my eventual Russian case agent, spy handler, if you will, showed up one day at the office, had never seen me, didn't really know about me, and was surprised, I'm sure a little bit alarmed to see me there. And so I knew I had access, Steve. I knew that there he is. I, you know, this is my office. I can make my move. And what did Navid Jamali decide to do as a way to kick things off? I decided to tell a joke. That's the only thing I could think of. So I went up to Oleg, who was my case agent, and told him a glasnost joke, which really went over pretty terribly. His reaction was something along the lines of, oh, I don't know anything about that. He was probably very concerned that I was trying to entrap him or get him to admit something you know, against Putin. And I realized from there that I had to be better prepared. So I knew I had access, but building a relationship really was a very, very difficult thing. I mean, obviously the Russians and they're an intelligence agency, they're incredibly paranoid and constantly looking for signs of deception or compromise on my part, and it was a challenge.
Well, when he got a little bit more comfortable with you, what was the first thing that you offered to him that perked him up?
He was interested. First thing we were able to get him, and this was with the FBI, was these conference proceedings to a military conference. And we got the material from the actual presenters who were doing, you know, the presentations. We got their PowerPoint presentations and a CD and a whole bunch of stuff. And I think for the Russians, it was that, but also one of the sort of turning points is that the Russians started meeting me clandestinely. That is to say, they started meeting me outside of my office. We started having unscheduled meetings at different locations. And I started slowly passing them information and more important information. But again, they were more interested in me. The goal here was for them to develop me as a spy who was going to be working for them for 5, 10, 15, perhaps even 20 years.
So when Oleg suggested you started to meet at these clandestine locations away from the store, and you told the FBI that this was really happening, what was your impression of what would happen then? Did you think that you'd get some kind of special training or preparation?
Sure. I would often ask them. I mean, this was all new to me. I had no idea really what I was doing. I took sort of traditional business world rules that I, you know, to do this. I treated this like almost like any other account. Oh, but by the way, it was with a Russian intelligence officer. So when I asked the FBI, like, you know, is there any schools? And they were very pleasant. They said, no, there really isn't. There was no training. They just said, you got to trust your instincts, which to me felt like, wow, I'm really kind of on my own on this.
What type of places would you meet Oleg? This is in New York City, right?
Spy aficionados might be disappointed to know that the Russians certainly had a penchant for meeting at really, like, mainstream chain restaurants. So Pizzeria Uno's, things like that. And, oh, by the way, Hooters, which was always a... Listen, if you haven't gone to Hooters with a Russian intelligence officer, you know, you haven't lived. It's definitely one of those things to cross off your bucket list.
So what was this guy, Oleg, who would become, I guess, your spy handler, what was he like?
Very smart, an incredibly intelligent guy, and very, very good at what he did. And what he did was to push me to try to get more, but it's a fine line. Look, you can't, if you coerce someone, if you threaten them, they're just not going to perform. So he pushed me, but came very close to that line. But more importantly, he was incredibly good at debriefing me. So we were meeting in person. This was in public places. He had an incredible way of asking me questions to check to see if I was lying. He would ask me the same questions numerous times in different ways. They could be months apart. He asked me a question from a meeting, you know, that occurred before. And it was all a way to see if I was telling the truth. And, you know, the slightest deviation, any of those, you know, minute, relatively insignificant details would have alerted him to the fact that potentially, you know, I was not telling the truth.
It's the Steve Fast Show on WJBC. If you are just tuning in, this hour we are talking with Naveed Jamali. For 3 years, he worked as a double agent, communicating with a Russian military intelligence officer, all the while working with the FBI. And he has written about it in a memoir called How to Catch a Russian Spy, The True Story of an American Civilian Turned Double Agent. Naveed, we were talking a little bit about how Russians just started to walk into your family's business, which dealt with acquiring records from a number of places. And Russians started to ask for specific records. The FBI was keeping an eye on that. And you, as a young man, decided, you know, I'm going to offer the FBI to kick this whole thing up a notch and see if I can get even more information from these Russians. They bit on your suggestion, both the FBI and your Russian contact, who's named Oleg in the book. Is that his real name?
It is Oleg Kulikov. That's his real name. No pseudonyms there.
And you said that he started to suggest that you meet offsite, away from the store, in places like Hooters. What was involved in getting to the point where you could convince Oleg? As you mentioned, he was a very smart guy. So did you figure he suspected you were trying to reel him in on something?
No. You know, I have to say that he was very smart, but there was a tinge of arrogance. And I think that he thought he'd caught a really big fish, in the sense that I was going to be someone who, look, they, you know, my parents had helped them, so there was that basis there, and he knew that I was applying to the military, and they looked at this and said, this is going to be a long-term source. This is someone who can escape the radar, kind of sail under it, and it's someone who shows the ability and the desire to help us, and as he progresses in his career, he'll be able to give us more and more stuff. This is great, and I think that arrogance kind of put a little bit of caution aside.
And it was his job to develop these sort of assets. And you write a little bit about what that's really like. You liken the process of developing an asset as a secret agent as really its sales.
This is cold calling. You know, the Russians, just like any intelligence service, the crown jewels are your human assets, which is a fancy word for spies. Now, an intelligence officer who's in New York or who's in Moscow is not actually the one who's going and actually spying. They're not going to a military airport and taking pictures with a telephoto lens. That's not, or breaking in and stealing stuff. But instead, what they're doing is they're meeting with their assets. They're meeting with their spies, who are the ones who are retrieving information. So that's their crown jewel. And Oleg, to his credit, was very good at that. And when I say about sales, they knock on doors. They cold call people. They have a profile. They'll call 20 people. Out of the 20 people, maybe 10 are worth a quick follow-up. Out of the 10, maybe 5 show some aptitude and willingness, and maybe out of the 5, maybe just 1 is enough to actually be someone who will be willing and able to spy.
Did you have to do anything yourself to sell yourself to Oleg, to convince him that what you were giving him was genuine and that you were really giving him valuable assets and you yourself were a valuable asset?
All the time. You know, as an asset, you're only an asset as long as you're an asset, right? You're only valuable as long as you're valuable. And when you're not, you know, there's no goodbye. You just never hear from them again. So, look, like I said, Oleg was constantly checking in our conversations for any signs of deception. I say conversation, but it really was a very intense negotiation that really was more along the lines of him, you know, essentially interrogating me.
So what sort of information were you able to give him to keep him on the line? And was it all genuine information? Did the FBI want you to feed certain things to the Russian military intelligence or give them just enough?
Yeah, no, this is a constant source of tension. How much information do you actually trade? You know, it's almost like being an undercover police officer in drug ring. There's some expectation that perhaps those undercover officers might have to, you know, do drugs in front of their nefarious counterparts to convince them. Here's the same thing. You're going to have to trade information. You can't just trade junk. You know, otherwise, the Russians are going to say, we love that you want to help us, but you can't get us anything useful. So thanks, but no thanks. So you got to trade something that has some value. But how much valuable stuff do you trade? At what point is the return on investment? So it's a very careful balance. Then there's the other part, which is, as I said, all I did was an interrogation. So I couldn't just show him a piece of information and say, here, I want to give this to you. He was going to say, where did you get it? And then when he came back the next time, that way, he said, okay, when you got this information, he said you got it from this place, what form did you use? And who was your sponsor? And in Block 14, you know, they were very, very thorough and very skilled, and it was constantly a check. So essentially what it meant, Steve, is I had to find information that organically I could have retrieved for the Russians and be able to defend it because you never knew what they were going to ask.
We're talking with Navid Jamali. His memoir about his time as a double agent is called How to Catch a Russian Spy. So all this time you're talking about these intense negotiations and interrogations regarding the information you're passing along to the military intelligence officer, Oleg. And all this time that this is happening, like in Pizzeria Uno and Hooters, there are parts of your book that seem like they are out of a regular spy novel and other parts like that that aren't. At any point when you're sitting there doing this, did it seem surreal? Did it think, this is not what I thought it would be?
Every day. It was the strangest thing because to some level I knew that Oleg was a Russian intelligence officer and as such was a point person for the Russian military, which, oh, by the way, has, you know, nuclear weapons. But I didn't see any of that. I just saw Oleg. I didn't see anything that was behind him. I didn't see his, you know, he had a chain of command. He had, you know, went all the way back to Moscow, most likely. I didn't see any of that. I just saw Oleg. And it was the same thing with the FBI. So I found myself, I understood practically that I was somehow between the FBI and the Russian intelligence agency, but I didn't see any of these pieces. And that was a way that kind of kept me sane. I think that if I had seen that, it would have been a little bit overwhelming in terms of being scared. But because I didn't see that, I just felt like this crazy Oleg, and I just wanted to beat him. I just wanted to outmaneuver him, and whatever reason, it worked.
Well, there were moments during this experience that maybe it did get a little bit more realistic or more like, I guess, the spy experience. They gave you a gadget?
Yes, they gave me, now it seems kind of old school when you think about Fitbits and Apple Watches, but I had a watch that the FBI gave me that I would use to record the conversations. And when the FBI gave it to me, it was like this G-Shock watch, which is, for those of you who know, it's a fairly big sort of watch that you might see on military types. And I looked at it, and I just felt like I was wearing like a Flavor Flav clock around my neck. This looked totally out of place, but it worked. And the Russians had their own gadgets. There were times where we'd meet with them where I was sure they were trying to jam anything because I was, at one point, we were in a car, and suddenly my radar detector went off, so I'm sure that Oleg had his own countermeasures, if you will. But yeah, it was really, look, there was some, the watch was the only device, the rest of it was just me thinking on my feet.
The FBI also gave you a code name.
Yeah, so what do you, so I'll tell two funny things about that. The first is, obviously, let me tell you what the code name was. It was Green Kryptonite, and when, you know, I had a very good relationship with the FBI, and so when I heard Green Kryptonite, my reaction was, what, My Little Pony was taken? Like, I just wanted to incessantly kind of give them a dig. But yeah, they gave me a code name, and like I said, because I had no sense of, I'd wake up some days and I'd be like, am I really in the middle of this counterintelligence operation? It seems so quaint. I had this grand idea that it would be all in good fun to go and have green kryptonite tattooed on my forearm in Morse code. So I went and did that, did not tell the FBI, and had to meet with Oleg from that point forward wearing long sleeve shirts. It was not one of the brightest moves I ever did, but you start doing this long enough, you go a little crazy, I think.
So who all knew at any level that you were doing this? You couldn't tell very many people, I would expect. Was it just you and Oleg and your FBI handlers?
Yeah, and they called it the Circle of Trust. And the Circle of Trust really consisted of my two FBI handlers. Obviously, Oleg didn't know, otherwise it would have been a very short story. And my wife. And that was it. That was the only people that knew about this.
Did they tell you you could tell your wife?
They actually did. They said, we understand the stress that this puts you through, and you know, whenever you're ready, you know, you can tell her and we can certainly talk to her. And it was thank God that I had her, because you need to have some outlet to be able to speak to someone about this.
How did that conversation go with your wife when you said, hey, I have something to tell you?
You know what? She kind of knew from the beginning. And I, for whatever reason, it just seemed like not much of an issue. I mean, we had her other lives going on. In many ways, it seemed so innocuous that it was sort of hard to see that this was this big deal. It wasn't really until the end, Steve, where we were invited to 26 Federal Plaza, which is the FBI headquarters, and we met the assistant director of the FBI, that we had any sense of the sort of magnitude of what I just done.
When this all came to an end, and you get into it in your book, there's going to be a movie based on your book, so it has a big ending to it. We won't go into too many details now. But when it was all over, when your service as this double agent ended, what did you think of that? Did you think, okay, somehow we'll do this again? What did it feel like to have this 3-year experience come to a conclusion?
You know, I was sad. I mean, if I could have kept doing this, I would have. It was. I mean, Steve, I would be lying if I said it wasn't terribly exciting. It was probably one of the more challenging things I've ever done. It was a real adventure. I mean, it was frustrating. It was scary at times, but it was also very rewarding. And again, I have to say that it really wasn't until the very, very, very end that I had any sense that anyone even knew, let alone cared about this. Nor did I have any sense of sort of the larger magnitude that this would have on other, you know, operations that the Russians and the FBI were running. So I certainly would have been happy to continue on at that level. It was rewarding in its own right.
We mentioned earlier that part of your motivation for taking the initiative and approaching the FBI to escalate this relationship and try to sell yourself as an asset to Russian military intelligence was you'd applied to a naval intelligence program and you didn't get accepted and you were sort of told, hey, bump up your resume. You did that.
Yes.
So in the end, you kind of got what you want.
I got in, I'm still in today. Yeah, I mean, that's certainly true. And this was really something, because I was a civilian and an amateur, that you really had. I had a lot of creative freedom. But yeah, in the end, look, I have a lot of respect for Oleg. He was very good at what he did. He was doing. It's not like he was ISIS or ISIL. These are patriots and nationalists in their own right. He was doing his duty. He was service as a soldier. But in the end, we beat them. And I do take great pride in the fact that I was able to sort of duke it out with a very skilled and senior Russian intelligence officer and be able to come out on top. And look, I'm here. I'm on your show. He's not. There's a little bit of kind of a sense of accomplishment with that. So I'm grateful for that opportunity.
Naveed Jamali tells his story in his memoir, How to Catch a Russian Spy, the true story of an American civilian turned double agent. We've been talking to him this hour. Naveed, thanks so much for being with us today.
You got it. Pleasure to be here.